This is the DMT 1-to-1 show, episode 8, recorded on the 3rd of May, 2013. Okay, it's great to be here on the 1-to-1 show, and this week our guest is Michela Magas, who is co-founder of the company Stromatolite, and also she's the founder of the Music Tech Fest. So we're going to talk about both of those things today. So hi Michela, and great to have you on. How's it going?
Hi, very well, thanks. We are sort of rushed off our feet, but still managing to sort of keep focus.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I wanted to start by talking about Stromatolite as a company, and then maybe move on to chatting about the Music Tech Fest, because that's coming up in just about 3 weeks, and it's super exciting. So first of all, Stromatolite started quite a few years ago. So can you just trace back the history of the company and what kind of projects you've been involved in over the years?
Well, we founded the company in 2000. It was Peter Russell Clark and myself. We started with it. There wasn't really an agenda. It was very much it very much reflected who we were at the time, and we were very much into design innovation. We were teaching students about new directions, and we were getting also projects that were with Nike Futures, for instance, to look at the future of the brand. So there were things that we found exciting, things that we believed in and we felt needed to be pushed through. Particularly at that time, it was innovation in the sphere of mass production and a product, as well as the future of the digital industries or digital applications, which, I mean, this sounds like a very long time ago now, but yeah. The landscape looked incredibly static, and we felt that innovation was really lacking in that respect.
Yeah, sure.
So this was basically the starting point. As it happened, we ended up working with people like Nike and Apple and Nokia on various different things. I got involved with Apple on the beginnings of iTunes, and especially when iTunes came over to Europe. I was working from them with them right from the start. But what happened there was that there was no R&D money to be, you know, thrown at. When Apple started in Europe, it had two people on marketing for 80-something countries.
Yeah.
So it had very low resources on that front. And I realized that if we were to go and explore this area, it had to be done without corporate money. And I was very lucky to be invited by a guy who came from MIT and who was he was applying for a project here in the UK from the grant bodies,
yeah,
together with Queen Mary, University of London, and Goldsmiths,
yeah,
for new ways of searching for music. It was an engineering project. I trained as a designer. I'm Royal College of Art trained, and so is Peter, incidentally. And I came from a background that's not customary to be included in those types of grants, but I was very, very lucky that they invited me along, because they heard of the work I was at that time doing with some of the ideas I was developing, both with iTunes and with Peter Gabriel's companies.
Yeah, sure.
In the meantime, things evolved on the product side within Apple, and Peter got invited to join the industrial design group, and Jonathan Ive's group, and as of January 2006, he went over there.
Yeah.
This was pre-iPhone. We came straight out of restructuring Nokia design teams just before that. So at that time, he was heavily focused on mobile phones, and he went straight in there on those projects.
Yeah.
Basically, this is how things evolved. I then ended up downscaling, and I plunged myself into research, many years of research. So following the invitation to join this project on new ways of searching for music, plunging at the deep end, literally, as a sort of trained designer and self-trained programmer. But we're talking about people who had spent, by that time, somewhere in the region of 6 to 10 years investigating audio signal processing and other ways of extracting information from music.
Yeah.
We're talking high level experts, which obviously I couldn't possibly match overnight. So it meant a huge amount of research and a huge amount of work to build the knowledge to be able to deal with these systems, not just at the front end, so not as a user interface expert, but as and not just in terms of front end innovation, but in order to innovate properly, one needed to know all the ins and outs and how the engineering aspects, the scientific aspects, work.
Yeah.
So this is quite a ride, you know. Yeah. It's a serious roller coaster.
Absolutely. And you always had like it's interesting to see that you had such a strong focus on brands and sort of collaborating with them as well with
That's
the music
right.
strand, because of course, you know, in the last couple of years, all we're hearing about the music conference is you know, how brands are going to save the day and how important brands are to musicians and all of that, which is questionable in itself. But
but
it's interesting that you were working in that field, you know, a long time ago.
Yes, but my experience was with commercial brands, with the innovation units in commercial brands.
Yeah.
Now I was tackling innovation from the academic side, because it is still, we're still talking, essentially, at the core, we're talking about the same thing. We're talking about innovating in the technological sphere and driving new business models with it. And it's at that junction becomes really important, because where you identify there are new tools available, you then need to turn them into a product that can be both understood by the mass market and applied by the brands, or has to be branded and then has to be disseminated and made useful by the major members of the music industry.
Of course.
But in order to do that, you also need business models that go with it.
Yeah.
And very often in our landscape, business models emerge as you start using a product. Case in point being Shazam, which started driving huge audiences over to iTunes. iTunes had to reassess how they pay people to drive their audiences their way, because there was such vast volume being driven their way, then they couldn't, it provided a very good engine for them.
Yeah.
So they need to reassess their model. But then, as it turns out, Shazam is now has now created new markets by working with American networks.
Of course.
So by attaching their system to the advertising that's on television, they could identify the song that's attached to an advert. And if someone sends, if someone identifies that song, they can send them vouchers for that particular product. So there's a whole loop of, there's a whole market that's been created in that space.
Absolutely.
This is something we couldn't have guessed several years ago when Shazam started. And it is admirable that the capital that's invested in these companies is based on the potential of this technology, without necessarily seeing where the revenue is going to come from, or perhaps assuming that one type of revenue is going to be available. But in truth, it turns out that if you stick with it, you might actually find some really lucrative revenue streams further down the line.
Yeah.
This is the sort of landscape we operate in. It's incredibly experimental, both on the business model side as well as on the technological innovation side.
Exactly. And it makes it, of course, for a company like Shazam, it made it a lot easier, the fact that it was not a company that was burning cash by paying labels for licensing fees. It was a relatively lean company where they could, it was just profit generating when they, you know, through affiliate, once they got the mass of users and they got the technology working, then the affiliate fees started to come in, and then it started to make sense as a business model. So
that's correct. Well, that was the first step in the business model. I think that they are the partnership with brands and with the television networks in America, I think is actually showing to be, I would guess, a lot more lucrative than just
of course
the affiliate program. So this is This can only happen once you start using this new technology and start discovering new ways of creating a market,
yeah,
and creating revenue. So on that side, it's interesting. It's interesting how technology impacts on new business models. So the technology that came out of my research and my PhD is basically focusing on a new way of searching for music that would open up back catalogs and up-and-coming artists and world music, so-called world music, which I, you know, it's a term which I really don't like, and you know, the idea of the genre of world music is just so patronizing from the West.
Yeah, that's right.
So this is something that was an ambition of mine. I was very interested to see what can be done in terms of opening up access to all these artists,
yeah,
opening up access to the long tail, and this was the starting point of the research. And of course, en route discovered a whole load of other applications and interesting issues that this research raises,
yeah,
both in terms of technical challenges and in terms of the applications and business models that can be created. So it's actually a really big space. And my PhD was a practice-based PhD,
yeah,
which is why, basically as part of this project, I was given a PhD grant. And the practice side of things basically just exploded, and it's now turned into two spin-offs already.
Yeah.
I have no time to write up with it. I'm being told off the whole time.
So yeah, Sonaris is actually one of the spin-offs, right?
Sonaris is one of the spin-offs that happened. It came from the PhD research and from working with all these phenomenal academics who really know their stuff. I mean, it's a wonderful space to be working in. It was aided by the Technology Strategy Board,
yeah,
where I applied to take this to market, to do a proof of concept, take it to market, because I believed it was the right time to do that.
Yeah.
And I was fortunate enough to get a grant from the Technology Strategy Board and invited a fellow PhD from the Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona to collaborate with me on this project, on this grant. And the two PhDs came together in ways that we didn't expect. So we came into it from slightly different approaches,
yeah,
both with intention of creating something that can be used by the mass market, particularly in the sense that all the matching of music that was being researched was predominantly researched in the classical music sphere, because these were the collections that people could access.
Yeah.
When you try to apply to popular collections, it was really difficult to get good results. And we wanted to focus on that. We wanted to create it as a useful tool for everyone.
Yeah.
And it just turned out that our two approaches, when they came together, the whole became this modern sum of its parts. So we had one of those moments of, wow, you know, did we really hear this? This is, you know, great. And we realized we were onto something.
Yeah.
We got a very good review by the Technology Strategy Board. And bear in mind, this was before, it was just at the beginning, when the Technology Strategy Board were beginning to think about the music industry as another potential area where they should encourage projects to go to. And we were asked to write a case study to submit to the government to show how new technologies can change the music industry business model as a result of this.
Yeah.
Because what this allowed to do was to create a licensing system where you could open up back catalogs of famous artists, and, you know, very typically a really big artist will be living off a handful of hits,
yeah,
and the rest is not really being used for licensing. And there are lots of up-and-coming artists who are cheaper to license for smaller productions, let's say short movies or digital productions, which are on the increase. And all of those could be made available as long as someone could find them and find the right sound for their movie or for their production. And this proved to be a very powerful business model. So we collaborated with Peter Gabriel and his venture Q Songs, which is a new way for licensing music.
Of course, we've had Ada on the show before.
Right. So we still work with them. And they have very successfully managed to convince all major labels to clear music, to pre-clear music for licensing. And it creates a very attractive model for all agencies and all companies, because all companies now have to have videos to promote themselves, and also at trade shows and trade fairs, it's all full of videos. And notoriously, getting music clearance is incredibly hard. One agency told us that for an internal presentation video, they had to pay £5,000 to clear the license for this piece of music that they wanted to use from a major label. These prices are really prohibitive, especially for smaller agencies. And the system now allows you to get music from, say £100 to maybe a couple of thousand if you need to run it for a long time or you need to run it on a global platform.
Yeah, sure.
So it's a very useful system in this growing market.
And so basically, you know, the what you're saying is that the technology of Sonaris was incorporated within the back end of...
The technology of Sonaris is being used for a whole load of experimentations and demos at the moment. The technology on the site, we implemented a really strong engine by a company called Barcelona Music Audio Technologies, which is really big on data. It has very large collections of data about every single piece of music, and this enabled us to launch the licensing system. What our technology is doing is looking at it more on the identifying the analyzing the audio itself, rather focusing on that principally, on adding some machine learning in order to teach the machine what cultural trends mean. And this is pretty tricky. This is very powerful. And these are the things we're experimenting with at the moment. So Q has got two sides to it. One is the publicly facing engine, which is driven by Barcelona Music Audio Technologies. And the other one is the pro side, where we are looking at new ways in which professional editors can access the segments of music or individual clips. The reason why we approach it in this way is because highly creative filmmakers, they have a very fixed idea of what they need with their visual, and they cannot go and search for something by describing a track as being singer, songwriter, etc., because it really doesn't give you the feel of it. What you really need is to say, here is the sort of sound I need for this 30 seconds in here. And if I want to access a large library of artists, not just production music, of course, plays a big part in this too, I need to be able to search for it with my ears. And what the way we approach it is we think of music as not a track, which is an old Motown a model, which was wonderful at the time, of course. It was a piece of vinyl, a nice length that fitted between radio transmissions, and Motown turned this into an art form, and we still stick to this 3 to 4 minutes of music. Now, it seems to be kind of a handy format that everybody kind of has latched onto. But as we well know, you know, this has been challenged early on. You know, you cannot search for the dark side of the moon by trying to describe it with metadata. It's a nightmare. So the way that we think about music is in terms of a musical phrase,
yeah,
a meaningful musical phrase. And we have algorithms that can detect musical phrases within music. And these then are matched by particularly mood, not mood in a very kind of crass way, mood in a it's a tricky one, because you know lots of people do very, very basic things with mood. They have like five moods and then everything belongs to one of them. When we say mood, is the best way to describe what I would call the zeitgeist. And this is because a piece of music evolves in real time. So if you ask my opinion on this, the piece of music is not finished once it's released out in to the open. It actually starts to live and evolve with the audience.
Yeah.
And so something is suddenly used for a movie, and I always quote the example from Reservoir Dogs. So if you do Stuck in the Middle, you know, you could have interpreted that piece in fairly innocent ways before it was used in the ear-cutting scene in Reservoir Dogs. But you have to be very aware of the cultural perception of that track. Otherwise, you know, someone might use it in a baby food advert or something like that, you know? So you can't allow that to happen. So what you have to be is aware of the significance of that piece of music and that cultural moment.
Yeah.
And that is particularly hard to achieve. You can't do that just with signal analysis, of course. The computer hasn't got a clue about these sorts of things. You can't do that just with crowdsourced tagging, because that would need to change from day in, day out. Someone would need to sort of add a tag and saying, violent scene, hello. So this is where it becomes really, really interesting, is how do you train systems to recognize that? And that takes quite a bit of work if you're trusting in that one. There are lots of different ways in which it's effectively music AI. And we really look at intelligence behind music, and we look at how we can train this to recognize, you know, the mood of a piece of music changes with the time of day, even, you know. I mean, typically and crassly, sort of as an example, you know, slow music is usually transmitted late at night, blah, blah, blah. But even so, you know, you would describe it with different words. If I were to ask you at 2 a.m. to describe me a thing, you would, I mean, depends on whether you're in a rave or whether you're just chilling, but you would probably describe it with different words than when I asked you first thing in the morning. So all of these things count, and we're building and building the knowledge and the AI behind music in order to be able to drive the system in an intelligent way. And then when the results come through, people just kind of gasp and they go, How did you get this exact same, sounds the same voice and almost the same words, and it's just really kind of freaking me out. And this is kind of, this is an unknown artist, and you just match it with a record that sold millions, and I go, whoa, yeah, there you go. And then it turns out that this artist has recorded before a famous artist, so it couldn't have copied, so there's no copyright infringement problem. So you're doing something that's totally legitimate. And you're discovering things that are now can be dragged out of the vaults.
Yeah.
Said, hey, guys, if you like this, you'll probably like that. So our latest sniffer that we've written is we are able to sniff anything you listen to on YouTube, from anything from your library. It basically sits in the background and listens. Bit like Shazam. Shazam kind of works by pointing your phone to in public spaces to sort of speakers. But we can have it on your desktop if you're a producer and you're watching a video and there's a piece of music in there that's really right for your movie. Of course, you could never afford to pay this band or whatever. You just turn on the sniffer. It goes 5 seconds and it just does that. It comes out with a list of, here's stuff that's available right now. It's like Getty Images. Click, license, download, off you go.
Awesome. That's
that fast.
That's fantastic. And just in case people were interested in that, that are listening, is this a beta program or is it something they can get from somewhere?
It's It's still beta. It's something that it's ready. It's working. It's we're processing the Q library at the moment. We're testing it for these pro situations.
Sure.
It's something that if people are interested, they can get in touch with us, and all demos are available.
Sure. Great.
So people can have a look and play with it if they wish.
Awesome.
To. So let them, you know, they can just get in touch.
Great. That's great. Well, that's fantastic. It's a really great insight on
Sonaris.org.
Sonaris.org.
There's just an info link.
Great.
On there. So they're welcome to, you know, because we're working with some of these partners, and this is something that is really just based on inquiries, individual
yeah.
inquiries at the moment.
Of course.
Thing that has happened. As a result of, there are three things that have happened as a result of the PhD research that I was doing. And another thing that happened was that I proposed to the European Commission to run the roadmap for the future of music technology.
Yeah.
Because I felt that that area was really left behind in comparison to gaming and broadcasting on
yeah.
their agenda. And music streaming is massive, as we all know. And when, at the time that I applied, it was becoming big. And I emphasized that this is an area that definitely needs to be explored.
Yeah.
And that the field of research of music information retrieval that I was part of needs to be opened up. And rather than it focusing chiefly on signal processing, it needs to be opened up to musicologists, to psychologists, to other fields that look at music, to other ways in which we can extract data about music in order to make these systems interesting and also more applicable to the mass market and more applicable to the music and creative industries.
Yeah.
And
sure.
fortunate enough that I had in the consortium, we had absolutely incredible partners, including Center for Digital Music at Queen Mary and Universitat Pompeu Fabra in Barcelona, which I mentioned earlier, IRCAM at the Centre Pompidou in Paris, which is the biggest French institute for this, OFI, Center for Artificial Intelligence in Vienna, Center in Eshkin Porto, and the Barcelona Music Audio Technologies. Hope I haven't missed anybody out.
Yeah.
Stuff
That's
going
nice.
On all the time.
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So these parts are absolutely phenomenal knowledge of this area, and we were able to, I mean, it was, people always tell you that public funding projects can either get terribly tiresome or boring or something, and our project, honestly, it was my feeling, but I think it was shared by the partners. We were all really sorry when we had to wrap up and finalize our roadmap earlier this month.
Yeah.
Because the conversations, and I'm not joking, the conversations in our workshops started at 9 in the morning and ended at 11 at night with people kind of falling over, but they were still enthusiastic and saying, well, you know, wondering, looking at all the different fields in which this can be expanded, all the ways
yeah.
in which we can formalize things. And,
wow, that's great.
It's really exciting. The roadmap is now, the project acronym was MIRES, MIRES, and it's MIRES.cc. The roadmap can be seen on there and can be downloaded from there, and I think it's going to make, hopefully, it'll make quite a difference because we've introduced huge amount of creative industries into it, which weren't there before, but also consolidated and expanded on the technical and scientific areas, introduced very much the multiculturalism aspect into music, so not research just done on Western collections.
Yeah.
So I keep going on about this. And also social media related things, which are incredibly relevant. And as part and parcel of this, I propose that we would join up academia and industry, and this is notoriously difficult. The reason being is that the two have to speak different languages in order to operate and
yeah.
survive. and do well in their sphere. There has to be a high focus in academia, and there has to be a very speedy, short, sharp decision-making process in the industry. And of course, the operators in these, the stakeholders, are trained to think in different ways, and therefore when they try to speak to each other, they just really find it difficult to translate. It's like being lost in translation.
Sure.
I was fortunate enough to be labeled innovation catalyst by the European Commission on this front, because I am able to speak both languages, and therefore I am able to connect the two. And as part of this, we decided that we were going to do some workshops and invite people from both academia and industry, but including everybody else. So sure. All the creative people who work in music, all the people who are hacking into music, people who are innovating and performing, looking at it from all sorts of different aspects, people who are crossing over into technology from being a performer, or people who are technologists who also play an instrument, or there are really lots of crossovers between science and art in this area, and it's actually really strong when you look at the history of music. Musicians always had some knowledge of engineering, or rather a great deal of the music industry have a lot of knowledge of engineering too. It is the nature of the beast. So in that sense, there was a lot of knowledge that could be shared. When we launched this idea, and I went and had 60 hours worth of meetings with all the different people in the industry and different SMEs and different people who are involved in developing new things for music, it turned out everybody was jumping at it saying, this is a great idea, we really need to all be in the same space, and we all need to be creative together. And it was very much a creative festival ideas that it turned into, with ridiculously low funding, with us not sleeping for days, or just gather it. And we're actually at that stage at the moment. And now we are non-profit. We're insisting at the moment on encouraging the crowd to come together, and we don't want it at this stage to be focused on revenue or anything like that.
Sure.
It just wouldn't be useful to all the people involved to be sidetracked by that. And I think it's very much about the community and about what the community can do. As a place where everybody comes in under the same roof, all these ideas that get exchanged produce a huge amount of value out there, which some people can monetize on, some people can develop as academic projects, etc. So it's up to them as to how they use it.
That's great. And so this is the Music Tech Fest, which is the second edition, is happening in three weeks.
That's correct. It's happening in 3 weeks' time.
So the dates are, what is it, the
17th to the 19th of May.
Great.
With the 18th and 19th being the weekend when all the hackers are active. So we're doing the 3D Music Hack Camp, where people are encouraged this year to make new instruments out of everything, that anything I can find.
Great.
And what I love about that is, and I don't want to sort of throw big words at people, but it's democratization of music making. Yeah. Because once upon a time, you had to have parents who can afford to buy a piano, and you, in order to have an instrument in the house, they cost money. Now you can get yourself an Arduino, you can get yourself some sensors super cheaply. If you are creative enough, you can actually turn anything into an instrument, and you can be really creative with it and start looking for new sounds, which is what we're really excited about. What's wonderful about that as well is that the labels seem to have woken up to the fact that there's this new scene, and there's some potentially interesting things that are coming out of it. They've put forward some signed artists' names to look at some of these aspects. So, for instance, just recently had an exchange with Jamie Cullum's managers, because Jamie's, we said to them he should really try the new piano keyboard called the Seaboard.
Yeah, sure.
And looked it up. It's a fabulous new.
I tried it out for South Bank.
We'd love to have someone like that try it. It turned out when they spoke to him that he'd already heard about it and he'd really wanted to try it. So we're trying to arrange for that to happen
Yeah.
At the moment, they're talking to. I just hooked them up, the two sides, and I just said, okay, you guys talk. You know, we're not doing it for any other reason that we want to actually have these two sides joined together, because we find that's where it becomes really exciting.
Absolutely, and so, it was that, you know, it's the same in the same way as when you people saw Bjork playing with the reactable table back in the day, and they were like going crazy, like what is this? What
and
is this?
And of course, she's a pioneer, and so is Imogen Heap, who is using new the glove in order connected to the Ableton in order to create a performance from it. So these are the pioneers in this space, absolutely. And of course, people like Carlos Lopez, who is a DJ on the Reactable. There are people now who exclusively perform with the iPad, Reactable on the iPad.
Yeah.
There are people who are really operating in that space, and they're the real pioneers. But you know, it's one of we're kind of here, and it's kind of doing this, and I quite like being.
Yeah.
Right there.
It's a question of bringing it.
Yeah, that's I usually operate in that spot. That's the kickstart sort of things. This year we're also doing an art hack in sync with the music hack. Last year we sold out on the art workshops before anything else. It was like 70 odd people who subscribed immediately. It was about synesthesia, about turning music into turning color into sound, and we developed an app which you can still download. It's called Synesthesia on the iTunes store, spelt in a European way, as in AE or a Latin way rather. That's still popular. That sort of you can go around, scan colors, and the accelerometer will using the accelerometer, you can change the pitch and you can modulate the sound. And people were last year at the festival wearing the festival t-shirts, which are all in very bright colors. Same as on the front of our website, which is musictechfest.org. You can kind of use the different colors to play them as a keyboard, and they have samples attached to them. So the reason why we wrote that was that we wanted people to come together in some way or other, because they all come from very different backgrounds.
Sure.
Encourage them to interact. So they all pointed their phone to each other's t-shirt and read the color from it, and they were able to jam together.
That's great.
A result. That was really popular. This year, the art hack, we are running 100 years since Russolo published The Art of Noise.
Right.
Noises, so basically one of the futurists, one of the famous Italian guys. Because he said, let's make noise with anything we can find. So it was kind of totally John Cage, but you know,
that's great.
1913 John Cage. And of course we're saying, okay, it's been 100 years, let's make music with anything, because what we're doing is counterposing the whole well-oiled machinery of the music industry, which produces terribly slick productions. And that's But you know, we look at it as one way of doing things, and what we can do is do it a very different ways. We can take all the components apart. We can start recreating the noise or the sound, and look at what can possibly happen in that space.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. And again, I would encourage the audience to go and check out a few websites. So starting with stromatolite.com, and then we move on to musictechfest.org, which is the event that's running. So if you are in London and you are free that weekend, it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, I think it runs on, you definitely should go and check it out and come along. And it's one of the very, very few events these days that are free. So you don't have any excuses on the budget front, so definitely try and make it down.
Come along, register for free. It's on Eventbrite, and come along and join us and just interact with everyone. This on Sunday we have a trio of beatboxers. There's a guy who's now writing an app for them to beatbox, like a three-way beatboxing app.
Awesome.
We have Jason Singh, who's just a phenomenal beatboxer. He was there last year and the crowd went crazy. So Jason, we have Shlomo, and we have Ezra, who's coming up in France. So there's some very interesting things that are happening on that front. So yeah, awesome. Come and join, register and come and join us.
Great. Well, I'll definitely see you there. And thanks so much for your time. It was a very interesting interview, and look forward to talking to you again soon.
Thanks, Andrea.
If you enjoyed the show, remember to check out our weekly music tech news show on digitalmusictrends.com.